7. The young recruit is silly. He thinks a suicide. He's lost his gutter devil. He hasn't got his pride. But day by day they kicks him, which helps him on a bit, till he finds himself one morning with a full and proper kit. Getting clear of dirtiness, getting done with mess, getting shut out doing things, rather more or less. Rudyard Kipling. I'm not going to talk much more about my boot training. Mostly it was simple work, but I was squared away, enough said. But I do want to mention a little about powered suits, partly because I was fascinated by them, and also because that was what led me into trouble. No complaints. I rated what I got. An MI lives by his suit the way a canine man lives by and with and on his doggy partner. Powered armor is one half the reason we call ourselves mobile infantry instead of just infantry. The other half are the spaceships that drop us and the capsules we drop in. Our suits give us better eyes, better ears, stronger backs, to carry heavier weapons and more ammo, better legs, more intelligence. Intelligence in the military meaning. A man in a suit can be just as stupid as anybody else, only he had better not be. More firepower, greater endurance, less vulnerability. A suit isn't a space suit, although it can serve as one. It is not primarily armor, although the Knights of the Round Table were not armored as well as we are. It isn't a tank, but a single MI private can take on a squadron of those things and knock them off unassisted, if anybody was silly enough to put tanks against MI. A suit is not a ship, but it can fly. A little. On the other hand, neither spaceships nor atmosphere craft can fight against a man in a suit except by saturation bombing of the area he is in. Like burning down a house to get one flee. Contrarywise, we can do many things that no ship, air, submersible, or space, can do. There are a dozen different ways of delivering destruction in impersonal wholesale. Via ships and missiles of one sort or another. Catastrophes so widespread, so unselective, that the war is over because that nation or planet has ceased to exist. What we do is entirely different. We make war as personal as a punch in the nose. We can be selective, applying precisely the required amount of pressure at the specified point at a designated time. We've never been told to go down and kill or capture all left-handed redheads in a particular area, but if they told us to, we can. We will. We are the boys who go to a particular place at H hour, occupy a designated terrain, stand on it, dig the enemy out of their holes, force them then and there to surrender or die. We're the bloody infantry, the doughboy, the duckfoot, the foot soldier who goes where the enemy is and takes him on in person. We've been doing it, with changes in weapons but very little change in our trade, at least since the time 5,000 years ago when the foot sloggers of Sargon the Great forced the Sumerians to cry uncle. Maybe they'll be able to do without us someday. Maybe some mad genius with myopia, a bulging forehead and a cybernetic mind will devise a weapon that can go down a hole, pick out the opposition, and force it to surrender or die, without killing that gang of your own people they've got imprisoned down there. I wouldn't know. I'm not a genius. I'm an MI. In the meantime, until they build a machine to replace us, my mates can handle that job, and I might be some help on it too. Maybe someday they'll get everything nice and tidy, and we'll have that thing we sing about when we ain't a-gonna study war no more. Maybe. Maybe the same day the leopard will take off his spots and get a job as a Jersey cow, too. But again, I wouldn't know. I'm not a professor of cosmopolitics. I'm an MI. When the government sends me, I go. In between, I catch a lot of sack time. But while they have not yet built a machine to replace us, they've surely thought up some honeys to help us. The suit, in particular. No need to describe what it looks like, since it has been pictured so often. Suited up, you look like a big steel gorilla, armed with gorilla-sized weapons. This may be why a sergeant generally opens his remarks with, "You apes." However, it seems more likely that Caesar's sergeants use the same honorific. But the suits are considerably stronger than a gorilla. If an MI in a suit swapped hugs with the gorilla would be dead, crushed. The MI and the suit wouldn't be mussed. The muscles, the pseudo-musculature, get all the publicity, but it's the control of all that power which merits it. The real genius in the design is that you don't have to control the suit. You just wear it, like your clothes, like skin. Any sort of ship you have to learn to pilot, it takes a long time, a new full set of reflexes, a difficult and artificial way of thinking. Even riding a bicycle demands an acquired skill, very different from walking, whereas a spaceship, oh brother, I wouldn't live that long. Spaceships are for acrobats who are also mathematicians. But a suit, you just wear. 2,000 pounds of it, maybe, in full kit. Yet the very first time you are fitted into one, you can immediately walk, run, jump, lie down, pick up an egg without breaking it. It takes a trifle practice, but anything improves with practice. Dance a jig, if you can dance a jig, that is, without a suit, and jump right over the house next door and come down to a feather landing. The secret lies in negative feedback and amplification. Don't ask me to sketch the circuitry of a suit, I can't. But I understand that some very good concert violinists can't build a violin either. I can do field maintenance and field repairs and check off the 347 items from cold to ready to wear, and that's all a dumb MI is expected to do. But if my suit gets really sick, I call the doctor, a doctor of science, electromechanical engineering, who is a staff naval officer, usually a lieutenant, read captain for our ranks, and is part of the ship's company of the troop transport, or who is reluctantly assigned to a regimental headquarters at Camp Curie, a fate worse than death to a Navy man. But if you really are interested in the prints and stereos and schematics of a suit's physiology, you can find most of it, the unclassified part, in any fairly large public library. For the small amount that is classified, you must look up a reliable enemy agent. Reliable, I say, because spies are a tricky lot. He's likely to sell you the parts you could get for free from the public library. But here is how it works, minus the diagrams. The inside of the suit is a mass of pressure receptors, hundreds of them. You push with the heel of your hand, the suit feels it, amplifies it, pushes with you to take the pressure off the receptors that gave the order to push. That's confusing. But negative feedback is always a confusing idea the first time, even though your body has been doing it ever since you quit kicking helplessly as a baby. Young children are still learning it. That's why they are clumsy. Adolescents and adults do it without knowing they ever learned it, and a man with Parkinson's disease has damaged his circuits for it. The suit has feedback which causes it to match any motion you make, exactly, but with great force. Controlled force. Force controlled without your having to think about it. You jump, that heavy suit jumps, but higher than you can jump in your skin. Jump really hard and the suit's jets cut in, amplifying what the suit's leg muscles did, giving you a 3-jet shove. The axis of pressure of which passes through your center of mass. So you jump over that house next door, which makes you come down as fast as you went up, which the suit notes through your proximity and closing gear, a sort of simple-minded radar resembling a proximity fuse, and therefore cuts in the jets again just the right amount to cushion your landing without your having to think about it. And that is the beauty of a powered unit. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to drive it, fly it, con it, operate it. You just wear it, and it takes orders directly from your muscles, and does for you what your muscles are trying to do. This leaves you with your whole mind free to handle your weapons and notice what is going on around you, which is supremely important to an infantryman who wants to die in bed. If you load a mudfoot down with a lot of gadgets that he has to watch, somebody a lot more simply equipped, say with a stone axe, will sneak up and bash his head in while he's trying to read a vernier. Your eyes and your ears are rigged to help you without cluttering up your attention, too. Say you have 3 audio circuits, common in a marauder suit. The frequency control to maintain tactical security is very complex, at least 2 frequencies for each circuit, both of which are necessary for any signal at all, and each of which wobbles under the control of a cesium clock timed to a microsecond with the other end. But all this is no problem of yours. You want circuit A to your squad leader? You bite down once. For circuit B, bite down twice, and so on. The mic is taped to your throat. The plugs are in your ears and can't be jarred out. Just talk. Besides that, outside mics on each side of your helmet give you binaural hearing for your immediate surroundings, just as if your head were bare. Or you can suppress any noisy neighbors and not miss what your platoon leader is saying simply by turning your head. Since your head is the one part of your body not involved in the pressure receptors controlling the suit's muscles, you use your head, your jaw muscles, your chin, your neck, to switch things for you, and thereby leave your hands free to fight. A chin plate handles all visual displays, the way the jaw switch handles the audios. All displays are thrown on a mirror in front of your forehead from where the work is actually going on, above and back of your head. All this helmet gear makes you look like a hydrocephalic gorilla, but with luck, the enemy won't live long enough to be offended by your appearance. And it is a very convenient arrangement. You can flip through your several types of radar displays quicker than you can change channels to avoid a commercial. Catch a range and bearing, locate your boss, check your flank man, whatever. If you toss your head like a horse bothered by a fly, your infrared snoopers go up on your forehead. Toss it again, they come down. If you let go of your rocket launcher, the suit snaps it back until you need it again. No point in discussing water nipples, air supply, gyros, etc. The point to all the arrangements is the same, to leave you free to follow your trade. Slaughter. Of course, these things do require practice, and you do practice, until picking the right circuit is as automatic as brushing your teeth, and so on. But simply wearing the suit, moving in it, requires almost no practice. You practice jumping because, while you do it with a completely natural motion, you jump higher, faster, farther, and stay up longer. The last alone calls for a new orientation. Those seconds in the air can be used. Seconds are jewels beyond price in combat. While off the ground in a jump, you can get a range and bearing, pick a target, talk and receive, fire a weapon, reload, decide to jump again without landing, and override your automatics to cut in the jets again. You can do all of these things in one bounce, with practice. But, in general, powered armor doesn't require practice. It simply does it for you, just the way you were doing it, only better. All but one thing. You can't scratch where it itches. If I ever find a suit that will let me scratch between my shoulder blades, I'll marry it. There are 3 main types of MI armor: Marauder, Command, and Scout. Scout suits are very fast and very long range, but lightly armored. Command suits are heavy on go juice and jump juice, are fast and can jump high. They have 3 times as much comm and radar gear as the other suits, and a dead reckoning tracker. Inertial. Marauders are for those guys in ranks with a sleepy look, the executioners. As I may have said, I fell in love with powered armor. even though my first crack at it gave me a strained shoulder. Any day thereafter that my section was allowed to practice in suits was a big day for me. The day I goofed, I had simulated sergeant's chevrons as a simulated section leader, and was armed with simulated A-bomb rockets to use in simulated darkness against a simulated enemy. That was the trouble. Everything was simulated, but you are required to behave as if it is all real. We were retreating, advancing toward the rear, I mean, and one of the instructors cut the power on one of my men, by radio control, making him a helpless casualty. Per MI doctrine, I ordered the pickup. Felt rather cocky that I had managed to get the order out before my number two cut out to do it anyhow. Turned to do the next thing I had to do, which was lay down a simulated atomic ruckus to discourage the simulated enemy overtaking us. Our flank was swinging. I was supposed to fire it sort of diagonally, but with the required spacing to protect my own men from the blast, while still putting it in close enough to trouble the bandits. On the bounce, of course. The movement over the terrain and the problem itself had been discussed ahead of time. We were still green. The only variations supposed to be left were in casualties. Doctrine required me to locate exactly, by radar beacon, my own men who could be affected by the blast. But this all had to be done fast, and I wasn't too sharp at reading those little radar displays anyhow. I cheated. Just a touch. Flipped my snoopers up and looked. Bare eyes in broad daylight. I left plenty of room. Shucks, I could see the only man affected half a mile away. And all I had was just a little bitty HE rocket, intended to make a lot of smoke and not much else. So I picked a spot by eye, took the rocket launcher, and let it fly. Then I bounced away, feeling smug. No seconds lost. And had my power cut in the air. This doesn't hurt you. It's a delayed action, executed by your landing. I grounded, and there I stuck, squatting, held upright by gyros but unable to move. You do not, repeat not, move when surrounded by a ton of metal, with your power dead. Instead, I cussed to myself. I hadn't thought that they would make me a casualty when I was supposed to be leading the problem. Shucks. And other comments. I should have known that Sergeant Zim would be monitoring the section leader. He bounced over to me, spoke to me privately on the face-to-face. He suggested that I might be able to get a job sweeping floors, since I was too stupid, clumsy, and careless to handle dirty dishes. He discussed my past and probable future and several other things that I did not want to hear about. He ended by saying tonelessly, "How would you like to have Colonel Dubois see what you've done?" Then he left me. I waited there, crouched over, for 2 hours until the drill was over. The suit, which had been feather-light, real seven-league boots, felt like an Iron Maiden. At last he returned to me, restored power, and we bounded together at top speed to BHQ. Captain Frankel said less, but it cut more. Then he paused and added in that flat voice officers use when quoting regulations, "You may deny trial by court-martial, if such be your choice. How say you?" I gulped and said, "No, sir." Until that moment, I hadn't fully realized just how much trouble I was in. Captain Frankel seemed to relax slightly. "Then we'll see what the regimental commander has to say. Sergeant, escort the prisoner." We walked rapidly over to RHQ, and for the first time, I met the regimental commander face to face. And by then, I was sure that I was going to catch a court, no matter what. But I remembered sharply how Ted Hendrick had talked himself into one. I said nothing. Major Malloy said a total of 5 words to me. After hearing Sergeant Zim, he said 3 of them. "Is that correct?" I said, "Yes, sir," which ended my part of it. Major Malloy said to Captain Frankel, "Is there any possibility of salvaging this man?" Captain Frankel answered, I believe so, sir. Major Molloy said, Then we'll try administrative punishment. Turned to me and said, 5 lashes. Well, they certainly didn't keep me dangling. 15 minutes later, the doctor had completed checking my heart, and the sergeant of the guard was outfitting me with that special shirt that comes off without having to be pulled over the hands, zippered from the neck down the arms. Assembly for parade had just sounded. I was feeling detached, unreal, which I have learned is one way of being scared right out of your senses. The nightmare hallucination. Zim came into the guard tent just as the call ended. He glanced at the sergeant of the guard, Corporal Jones, and Jones went out. Zim stepped up to me, slipped something into my hand. Bite on that, he said quietly. It helps. I know. It was a rubber mouthpiece, such as we use to avoid broken teeth in hand-to-hand combat drill. Zim left. I put it in my mouth. Then they handcuffed me and marched me out. The order read, In simulated combat, gross negligence, which would in action have caused the death of a teammate. Then they peeled off my shirt and strung me up. Now here is a very odd thing. A flogging isn't as hard to take as it is to watch. I don't mean it's a picnic. It hurts worse than anything else I've ever had happen to me. And the weights between strokes are worse than the strokes themselves. But the mouthpiece did help, and the only yelp I let out never got past it. Here's the second odd thing. Nobody even mentioned it to me, not even the other boots. So far as I could see, Zim and the other instructors treated me exactly the same afterwards as they had before. From the instant the doctor painted the marks and told me to go back to duty, it was all done with. Completely. I even managed to eat a little dinner that night and pretend to take part in the jawing at the table. Another thing about administrative punishment. There is no permanent black mark. Those records are destroyed at the end of boot training, and you start clean. The only record is one where it counts most. You don't forget it.